So what we're going to do is finish Mark chapter 6 today, a few verses, one vignette, and then we're going to look at the first part of Mark chapter 7, another vignette. There are some critical, precedent-setting things that Jesus says in these two passages. In fact, if you can't recall to mind immediately all of the details of these stories, or you've not heard them ever taught in detail before, you're going to be astonished that the church could believe some of the things and practice some of the things that it does globally in light of what Jesus says right here. You think, well, then wait a minute. Jesus says this, then why do they do this? And I think that's a very good question. And I know my experience growing up was that because the church didn't really study the Bible. We didn't get our ideas of what you did from the Bible. We got them from the traditions of our denomination and our momentum. Well, this is the way we've done it for 25 years, and we like it, so don't bug us with that scripture stuff. And that happens a lot more than you would think. So let's open our hearts and our minds to what God wants to say to us. As my third grade teacher, Mrs. Hickerson, used to say, let's put on our thinking caps and allow God to recalibrate us if necessary. The first passage that we're going to look at, the first vignette, and I think I'm going to read them separately and talk about them separately, just like we did last week. The last time we saw Jesus, we saw him, and these two events are connected, is why I want to break it up a little bit. The last time we saw Jesus, the disciples flunked a test, which we're going to see this week would have saved them some needless turmoil. And that's always true. God, who knows of the future, who knows us, he knows what's coming down the pike. He knows that what's going to blow us out of the water. He always prepares us. Many times I've said, Lord, I did not expect this. And he said, but I did. And you have been prepared. But we just don't always connect the dots. And so we're going to see the disciples who flunked a test last week, flunking another test. It's so comforting, isn't it? That he didn't fire them. He just knew it was going to take him a while. I just love that he engineers circumstances in our lives to prove who he is in our own experience. So last week, we saw them participating in a miracle of scientific proportions, a miracle of the laws of physics. Thousands of people, 5,000 men, plus women and children. So I don't know, conservative estimate, there could have been 9 or 10,000 people there. How many times does 10,000 go into five fish sandwiches? The disciples participated in that miracle. But the thing that we looked at last week, the lesson of the loaves, please pick that CD up if you weren't here. It will be very illuminating. We're going to see in this passage today, Mark says that in the circumstances of the lesson today in their lives, the test of faith today, it says they were afraid because they had not learned the lesson of the loaves and the fish. And the lesson of the loaves and the fish was, talk to Jesus, don't just tell him what the need is, factor him into the equation as part of the solution, and they never did. They came to Jesus and told him the need. They actually told him to send everybody away. They never asked him. They never considered him meeting the need of all those hungry people who were only there because they wanted to be with Jesus. And John tells us in John's account of that, that whole thing happened as a test for the disciples, because Jesus already knew what he was going to do. Can I promise you that? Jesus always already knows what he's going to do. Just because I don't, just because you don't, doesn't mean he's making it up as he goes along. He already knows. So that was the lesson that they failed. And we'll see how it could have been different in this week's episode. We stopped at verse 44 of Mark chapter 6. I'm just going to read to the end. We'll talk about it a little bit. So immediately after the feeding of all of those people, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to Bethsaida. We'll be there when we go to Israel. We may even have a fish sandwich there. While he dismissed the crowd. So Jesus sends the disciples ahead. Do you smell a setup happening? Because that's what's happening. This is another setup, another opportunity for them to trust him. So he sends the crowd away after he sends the disciples away. And after leaving them, he went up on a mountainside to pray. He did that a lot. When evening came, the language in the other Gospels, in fact, one of them tells us what time. It was 6 p.m. So you might want to write that in your margins because it plays into the plot line of our story. So at 6 p.m., the boat was in the middle of the lake. Too far, just as far to go back as it was to keep going forward. And he saw the disciples straining at the oars because the wind was against them. The word straining should be circled. That's highly sanitized. It literally means tormented. About the fourth watch of the night, he went out to them walking on the lake. Right in your margins, 3 a.m. Because that's the fourth watch of the night. So, do the math. 9 hours rowing, helpless. Jesus is watching. And he waits 9 hours till they're at a spot where it's just as far to go back as it is to keep going forward. They're totally worn out. And then he goes to them. This may clear up a lot of things for some of you who are wondering, why did God let it get this bad before he did anything? I love this passage. It's so comforting. He was about to pass by them. So don't miss the phrase, walking on the lake. Now, Mark totally leaves out the Peter walking on the water thing, which is makes great sermons, but Mark doesn't record it. But we've already studied the other three Gospels, so I won't even talk about that today. But Jesus is walking on the lake out to them. He was about to pass by them. In fact, the flavor of the Greek is that he acted like he was going to go past them. But when they saw him walking on the lake, they thought he was a ghost, and they screamed, literally. Very unmanly word. They screamed because they all saw him, and they were terrified. Immediately, he spoke to them and said, "Take courage. I am," literally. My NIV says, "It is I," and that misses the whole point. The words that he said in Greek were, "I am," which, remember, God told Moses, that's my name. Any Jewish boy, any Jewish girl that heard somebody say, "I am," would think that is either blasphemy or that's God talking. So he said, "Take courage, I am, don't be afraid." There's a fabulous rabbit trail there, isn't there, that sequence? And then he climbed into the boat with them, and the wind died down. And Mark, this is another one of those things my NIV leaves out, but the wind immediately died down. Does that sound familiar? Jesus walking into a storm and doing something, saying something, and the wind immediately stops. Same body of water, same guys, probably the same boat, same Jesus. And yet they freaked out. And then when he calmed it down, it says they were completely amazed because they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. Underline that phrase, not understood. It's the word for learning a lesson by connecting the dots. The connect the dots word, suniemi, which is one of my favorite words. I'm going to read it that way. They were completely amazed. First, they're freaked out. because they hadn't learned the lesson. Now they're amazed when he calms the water. He just did it a matter of a few hours earlier. And the reason for the fear and the amazement was they had not connected the dots about the loaves and the fish. Their hearts were hardened. When they had crossed over, they landed at Gennesaret and anchored there. As soon as they got out of the boat, people recognized Jesus and they ran through the whole region, carrying the sick on mats to wherever they heard he was. And wherever he went, into villages, towns, or countryside, they placed the sick in the marketplace and they begged him to let them touch even the edge of his cloak. And all who touched him were healed. Word must have gotten around. Remember a couple of weeks ago? The woman whose theology wasn't that great and thought, well, if I just can touch his coat, I know I'll be healed. And he was, and she was. So that's as far as we're going to get for our first vignette, and there's lots of good stuff to talk about. I promise you some of it will be convicting. Don't worry, I've not been reading your mail. I was accused last week of bugging a few people's houses, but that's what I love about God's Word. It hits me right exactly where I am. Remember, the book of James said, you know, if I will look at it that way, it'll be like looking in a mirror. Yeah, I may not like what I initially see, but God shows me so that he can fix it. And so all of these lessons they're so poignant. I've just looked at the string of what we've been studying. I'm thinking, this is it. This is where we live. This is our life. So this is good stuff. So back to verse 45, Jesus, I do find it kind of comforting if you stop to think about it. He gave them something familiar to do. They just flunked a test. He brought the, if you will, he brought the test, the next test, which they had already, he'd been setting them up so that nothing would shake them. He'd been showing them his faithfulness in a variety of situations. So now he just went back to the field of their expertise. Most of them were fishermen. Most of them spent their whole life on or around that sea. So he sent them out on the water. But notice how they're set up. I used to not like this about the Lord until I got to know his heart. And then when I got to know his heart, I realized he knows me so well. He knows exactly the way to engineer the perfect circumstances where all of my worst qualities are going to come to the surface, where I truly believe in my delusional brain that I actually trust God, and I do on some subjects, but on other subjects, it's just out of there. I act like all that stuff I know about God over here isn't even true, and mostly it's because I don't apply it to this one area. And we all have our panic button subjects, don't we? It's like that thing when I used to lift weights when I was in my 20s. But I only lifted weights that for the muscles that were easy for me. And I remember the coach coming and saying, Cull, heads up, buddy. You need to do something. And he told me a bunch of different exercises. And I said, well, I don't want to do those. Those are hard. And he says, and why are they hard? They're hard for you to do because you don't have those muscles. You're working on muscles you already have. So God is going to run us through things if we don't get it the first time. He's going to run us through things that teach us the lesson that we need to know. And the primary lesson in all of these events that have happened that we've looked at over the last month is whatever the circumstances, however scary it is, however impossible it looks, do not leave Jesus out of the equation. Don't just come and tell him the need and then recite all of the human resources. Ask him. Invite him to help. And of course, I have to tell you, that's the thing I pray for you guys more than any other thing. Every single day, sometimes many times a day, your names and your faces are in my heart. And the thing I pray more than any other thing, more than blessing, more than protection, more than piles of money to fall out of heaven into your bank account, I pray that you will call on the Lord. that you will involve him, engage him in your lives. Because I know what he's going to do. It's a no-brainer when we do that. It's the Jeremiah 33:3 thing. Call on me, and I'll answer you. And I'll show you great and mighty things that you don't now know, God says. So he gives them something simple to do that's familiar. He tells them he made them. It's a strong word. He constrained them to go out on the sea. Now, John gives us one little tidbit in his narration in the Gospel of John that I think is very useful here. Jesus is basically vacating the area, and John in John 6:15 tells us this. He left that area because he knew that they were going to try. They were going to make an attempt to make him their king by force. I find it interesting that Jesus always resisted the effort for a Christian government takeover. He always did. He was never on the side of that. So there's lots of people that would like him to be today. It wasn't time, for one thing. He wasn't going to set up his kingdom in the way they wanted right then. That was going to come later. There were some stuff to do that involved rejection and hostility, something that didn't fit into their agenda. So John says that's the reason that the disciples and Jesus vacated the area. So he sends them out on the sea in the boat, and then he went up on the mountain to pray. I can say this because Marion's not here today, and she would be offended probably that every time I say Maine doesn't have any mountains, you know, she grew up in the mountains of Maine, but they're not mountains. They're hills. The tallest mountain in the East Coast is a hill compared to where I'm from. We're probably from where you guys are from out in Colorado. I used to look right out my front window at a mountain that was 15,000 feet high. It had glaciers. It was a volcano that had filled in with snow. Year-round, there was 200 feet of snow on top of it. So that's a mountain. What? You didn't have to say that, Bob. No, I didn't, but I just love irritating people. I do find it interesting that Jesus went up in the mountains to pray. Those of you that love mountains know that there's something about it. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the fresh air. Maybe it's the stillness. But he seemed to love to. I do find it significant. Please don't miss this. This is the Son of God. And he felt like he had to often get away and talk to his Father. So who do I think that I am that I don't need that? You know what I mean? You know how we get? Everything can crowd that out. And here's the Son of God, eternity past to eternity future, the same, fellowship with God. But see, I think one little secret of why Jesus did this often. He said, I only do the things my Father tells me to do, and I only say the things my Father tells me to say. How's that going to happen if you don't have lots of time with your Father? How do you know? Everybody else's voice screams. So I do find that poignant. So about 6 p.m., he sends them out. Notice this sequence. It's kind of an interesting sequence. 6 p.m., boat was in the middle of the lake. And he was alone on land, and he saw the disciples tormented at the oars because the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he went out to them. So there's 9 hours. Middle of the lake. This just begs all kinds of questions to me. Why didn't he go sooner? Why let them be tormented for 9 hours? By the way, they knew the conditions that they were in. These were not landlubbers. These were guys who knew the life-threatening conditions. They knew exactly what it was like to be totally worn out and making no headway against the wind. Why didn't he do something sooner? I don't know. I just know his timing is perfect. I remember when we studied the book of Nehemiah, one of the things that we saw this exact same principle. Under pressure from the enemy, nothing happened until it was just as far to go back as it was to keep going forward. There was a strategy involved of God where we got to a place where we've gone this far, and it doesn't look like we're going to be able to go any farther. And God is saying, and come on, work with me. So are you going to talk to me now about it? Are you going to involve me? Are you going to give up your own efforts? Are you going to just surrender to me? I do find it interesting that Jesus could have calmed the wind from the mountain. Couldn't he? I mean, he saw how hard it was. He could have just gone booga booga or whatever you do with when you're going to stop wind. I mean, it stopped immediately according to his time. So it wasn't like it was out of his control. In fact, that's the troubling thing, isn't it? It was in his control. And he let him sweat it out for 9 hours. I was looking through this and I underlined in verse 48, he saw the disciples tormented. How did he see them tormented? He's on the mountain, they're on the water. He had to have been watching them. In fact, one of the Gospels uses those very words. It says he was watching them. So here's my first little rabbit trail. Sometimes God will allow our faith to be exercised and tested even by allowing us to struggle a while with no visible results, giving us a chance to apply what we know about him to the circumstances that we're in now. But he's always watching, and he's always able to come to us at the appropriate time, even if it's in unexpected ways. That's what I love about this story. I have to admit, unless I learn the lesson of the loaves and the fish, I'm freaking out at all the wrong times. I'm surprised at all the wrong times. The minute we take what it is that we know is true about God and we apply it to every circumstance, that's the minute we begin to live the life of faith. So that's why God allows new circumstances. That's why I wasn't expecting this conversation that I had with the Lord, and the Lord says, yeah, but I was. This didn't sneak past me, Bob. And I've been watching, and at just the right time, he comes. Why didn't he calm the storm from the mountain? It wasn't lack of ability. Why did he wait 9 hours? It wasn't lack of concern. He was watching the whole time. Why come to them in the way that he did? Now, wouldn't you think, same body of water, probably the same boat, same guys, same Jesus, and remember, he calmed the storm, he stood up and he told the winds and the waves, shut up, and immediately it calmed down, and they looked at each other and they said, who is this? That's a really good question, because I don't think we know, do we? We so underestimate him. But what I just find so humorous is then he goes from that situation and he goes to the, okay, let's try the food thing. Let's try the human resources versus God resources test. Okay, let's do that. And he does that, and they participated in that miracle. They didn't have to read about it. They didn't have to take somebody's word for it. They were standing there passing out the food as it's multiplying. 12 baskets left over, enough for their needs as well. And they didn't connect the dots the next time they got out on the very same body of water that Jesus had calmed. Do you sense a pattern in that? I have to tell you, I didn't for years. I'm embarrassed to even tell you how old I was after all of the faithfulness of God for decades in my life, how old I was before I started even connecting the dots in all of these things. I tended to react to each trial like it's the only trial, and all the stuff that God did before didn't count because now this is the trial that I'm in. In fact, there's the with finances, there's this really stupid and dangerous thing that we do, that we have this big need pile up, and then when God comes through miraculously and he meets the need, we have 5 minutes worth of rejoicing before we already start worrying about what's he going to do next month. And that thing that's supposed to be building up a story and a log and a history in our lives of God's faithfulness gets lost. Because we're not making a conscious effort to say, the God who was faithful here will be faithful here, is going to be faithful there, he's going to be faithful. Wouldn't we have our lives be so much easier if we just believe that? But what I find so comforting about God is he says, I'll prove it. You don't want to just believe me? I'll prove it. Remember the thing that Jesus said to the disciples after the storm incident? He said, how is it possible that you still don't trust me? After all you've watched me do. Well, they're human. So we're seeing, I don't know how many makeup tests this is. We're just seeing so many. He's just running them through it again. He's running through them again. Let's just do something that they'll remember. Of course, I love that it's recorded for us. Although, of course, we're never like this, so I don't know why we need to know this, right? I mean, we never do this. These bozos, what's wrong with them? You know, aren't you glad we're not like this? Well, but we are, aren't we? So this is for our instruction so that we don't suffer needlessly. He saw them, and after 9 hours, he went out to them. From 6 p.m. to 3 a.m., that's enough time to watch the last light go out of the sky, enough time to see the first light start up in the morning. You've been rowing and rowing. I can't even imagine rowing for 9 hours. They would have had to have taken turns. When we go to Israel and we get to see a boat that they dug up out of the mud, that they carbon dated and found out it was in Bethsaida, of all places. It was a fishing boat from this very time. It's pretty exciting. Buried in the mud, preserved in the mud for 2,000 years. So they're rowing this boat. They're in the middle. I mean, just all of these things, it's all... Okay. Hello, guys. Okay. Anybody want to call to Jesus? Anybody want to pray? Anybody want to ask Jesus to rescue them? No, they just tried harder. So God sometimes has to just let it get impossible. Boy, and you know what? That's a more common thing than you would think. I always think of the story of Gideon. I even wrote a little booklet about it. That sometimes God lets things get more impossible before he fixes them. And we're saying, oh, God, it's impossible. And God's saying, oh, no, I can get a lot more impossible than this. And with Gideon, the whole point was God was just saying, I am going to rescue you because I always rescue my people. But if I do it in the way you want me to do it, you'll think it was you. So God says, I'm just going to let it get so impossible nobody but me could fix it. And then hopefully when I do, you'll say it was me and you'll stop just trying harder. You'll immediately take everything to Jesus. And, of course, that was what this was all about. Isn't it kind of interesting, verse 48, it says he was about to pass by. He acted as if, I think the Amplified Bible says, he acted as if he was going to pass by. And I don't know, it doesn't tell us why, but I'm wondering why. Why trot out there on the water, you know? Oh, boys. You know what? Maybe he was just knew it was going to freak him out, and he just wanted to get him used to a guy walking on the water. Maybe it was that. Maybe that was what it took to get them to even call out to him. That's my personal belief. I think that's why we've all been hearing the lessons over the last few weeks. You get just a little bit of a glimpse of Jesus in the midst of your turmoil, and there's this impulse in your heart to want to call out to him. And I think that's what it's all about. So did they? No, they screamed. They screamed in fear. One of the most unmanly words in all of the Bible. They screamed like little babies for fear. Now, I just love the Bible. I just love that it's God shows people warts and all. I love that. I think it's so sad that we make superheroes out of them, and we take all of the pith and humanity out of it, and therefore the Bible doesn't relate to a lot of people. But these are just weenies. These are guys that are just weenying out. They have absolutely no reason to. And I've heard one commentator that said, well, you know, it was a common belief that if you saw a ghost, that meant that you were going to die soon. Yeah. But why are they screaming like little babies? Has Jesus even come into their thinking? Don't you think there would be at least one of them? How many of them are there? 12? Do you think there would be one of them that would say, hey, remember the loaves and fish? Hey, remember the storm? Remember the demon guy? Hey, remember, Jesus is up there somewhere. They didn't recognize that it was Jesus walking on the water toward them. That wasn't the first thing in their mind. And I want to talk about this. It reminded me of talking with Aaliyah last night about being afraid of the dark. I suspected that she was a little bit afraid of the dark, and I thought it might make her feel better if I told her that I was too for a long time in my life, and that Jesus made it better. Isn't it amazing what conclusions we jump to when we're afraid? The devil can just throw one little suggestion out there and it seems perfectly plausible. I'm an expert at this. Like I said, I was dominated by fear for a good deal of my life. It's amazing that in the dark, knotty pine paneling looks exactly like monster eyes. And turning the light on doesn't help. Because you just see it's just knotty pine paneling when you turn the light on. But then when you turn the light off, it's monster eyes again. It's amazing we jump to the worst possible conclusion if we're afraid enough. I think the only cure for that is for us to learn to know him, to learn to know his heart, to learn to know his power, and to learn it in our own experience so it's not somebody else's stories. Even if we believe them, it's not the same as having your own story. There's something very, very powerful. Some of you are in a situation now, you are going to have such fabulous stories to tell people about God's faithfulness. But we're trying our best to get out of those circumstances, aren't we? But he's wanting to prove himself. And I do find it interesting how when we're afraid, we just jump to the worst possible conclusion. It's a ghost. Nobody's thinking it's Jesus. Calm down. They're thinking it's a ghost. Freak out. Scream like babies. Come on, man up, you know? Okay, let me just say this. It was normal to be afraid under those conditions. They're exhausted. They knew the waters. They were getting nowhere against the storm. It's not normal to see somebody walking toward you on the water at night. The fear part of it was normal. except a few hours earlier, they had seen Jesus defy the laws of science and physics. A few hours before that, they'd see him do it on that very same body of water. So the fear should have been assuaged immediately by what they knew was true about the Lord. But that's the lesson, isn't it? The lesson is this thing I'm in right now isn't the whole story. Just look back over your shoulder. Look back at what God's already done. Look at his faithfulness. This is another one of those places, verse 50, where Jesus says the most inappropriate thing. I added these up one time because being a guy that was dominated by fear well into my middle age, I added up the things that Jesus said to his disciples, and hands down, no contest, the thing he said to them most often was, stop fearing. It's the negative of a present tense verb. It's not, if you're ever afraid, don't be. It's, you're afraid now. Stop it. Remember the last episode when we saw Jairus? He comes and gets Jesus because his daughter's on the verge of death. He loves his little 12-year-old girl, and as he's bringing Jesus to, that's faith, bringing Jesus to intervene, the woman touches the hem of Jesus' garment, everything seems to get hung up and delayed, and then the bad news comes to Jairus and says, don't bother Jesus anymore, it's too late. She's dead. What did Jesus say to Jairus? He said, you're doing great, buddy. Just keep believing and stop fearing. Oh, Jesus, how insensitive can you be? This man's girl just died. Jesus, how insensitive can you be to tell these guys to stop being afraid? Well, see, that's never the whole story. We always have a choice. Boy, there's folks I wish were here today, because they're dominated by fear just like I used to be. And they need to hear these words. You are not at the mercy of your emotions. Emotions are not scientific instruments. They're real, but they don't always measure reality. Fear is real, but it doesn't always measure reality. There's always the God factor to be factored in.